class, the new, we started new material with 2A4 on the outline, moral impotence. And then we covered 1, 2, and 3 under B, the healing vector. And what we attempted to describe in the last class was the experience of our inability to sustain our own development as human persons. That inability obviously can come from other domains besides the one that we're focusing on in this course. And in no way do I intend to try to take the position that this perspective is all-embracing. The inability to sustain our own development can be rooted in social injustices as well as in the affective crippling of the individual person. And the full picture would have to create, would have to show how these two are related to one another. I'm trying to do that to a certain extent by placing the whole affective problem within the context of social history and how, for instance, the victimization of the person's own psyche is a function in part of the social historical condition and so on and so forth. But the full analysis of that we're not going into in this particular course. But the thing that we're trying to indicate is the affective dimension of moral impotence. Say they are but one aspect, but an important one. There are certain conditions under which a person is unable to adopt the intelligent, rational, responsible posture towards his or her own darkest forces. He's unable to take compassion upon them. Because to take that posture of compassion demands that one already has to have a certain freedom from the affective darkness and not be overwhelmed by it, and has to have some acceptance of it. That will enable one to treat it with compassion rather than with hatred. And it's possible for us to get into a situation where we either do not have that freedom because we are overwhelmed by our affective darkness, or we are incapable of accepting it as something that needs to be healed because we hate it, and we hate its intrusion and its interruption and its violence in our lives. So this freedom has to be given from beyond the creative vector. And the freedom is given through the gift of unconditional love. And the acceptance of ourselves is given through the gift of unconditional love. That gift opens up a free space in our own inner being. And it gives us rest, enabling us to adopt a new posture in our own regard. The rest that comes from love, enabling us to be somewhat free enough to begin to deal with our own darkness, and free enough to be able to accept it as something that stands in need of healing, to treat it with a healing attitude, a compassionate attitude, a therapeutic attitude. Something that Gregory Baum said the other night, Friday night, when he was talking about reading Karl Rahner, and reading how Rahner speaks about those moments in which we essentially come to a position of rest and are able to reflect upon our lives. And how he said that the social conditions are such that many people are unable to have that kind of time and leisure, where the gift of love can't be mediated to them to free them because of the pressures that are caused by their own social situation. Baum tended to make that a condition simply of the poor and the oppressed. I myself believe that that is written into the social structure that we're all involved in. This demonic force that's present that would keep all of us from that ability to step back from what we're involved in and reflect upon it and begin to take up perhaps a new attitude towards it. I don't think it's simply the condition of the poor and the oppressed, but I think that we're all into it to a certain extent. The inability, if, you know, there's a trap that we can all get into to keep us from stepping back and reflecting upon our lives, beginning to take a new posture in this regard.
I get the feeling that we all can get locked into it and get locked into the idea that oppression is greater than poor. Oppression our life, all of us, and that oppression is a real problem.
It's focused in the poor in a way, but if we're talking about a totalitarian tendency in contemporary society, the totalitarian means it's going to hit everybody. If it really is totalitarian, and I'm convinced it is. You were at the presentation the other night, Joe Holland was right on target, speaking about escalating totalitarianism in Western society. There's no question about it, and it's hitting everybody. But it comes to focus, and that's where the hermeneutical privilege of the experience of the poor, I think, is right, because it comes to focus there in a way that's unmistakable. But we're all hit by it. Okay. Love, then, works from above downwards in human consciousness, beginning in that experience of resting in the love of another, and progressively opening up and freeing the blockages that prevent self-transcendence in the person. It begins in that fifth level of consciousness where we rest in love, and it moves downwards. Now, it's my position that for love to be able to sustain the healing process, it has to originate from beyond another human being. It must be divine love that can sustain that healing process. No matter how much that love is mediated through another human being or mediated through a human community, it's divine love that can sustain the healing process. And in fact, human love begins to go astray when the lover tries to be the source of healing for the beloved, or when the beloved looks to the lover as the ultimate source of salvation. That's one of the traps in human love. Whereas if human love is regarded as a mediation of the force of divine love in the world, then the healing process has a much better chance of being sustained through the mediation of human love. Okay. Now, our Christian tradition has emphasized that, yes, there is a gift of divine love, and that it is freely offered, and that the experience of it is a radically affective experience. Falling in love with God is the expression that Lonergan uses to describe it. The acceptance of the offer of divine love is religious conversion. And religious conversion starts a process that leads the person to ever greater familiarity with the God who offers the gift of love. Religious conversion is the beginning of the process of the love relationship between the person and God. The process goes on, and it leads to ever more deeply into a life of religious love and religious union, mystical union. But religious conversion and mystical union are two different things. Religious conversion is the process that starts with the offer of the gift of God's love and leads to union. But don't think of conversion as being the end of the process. It's the beginning of the process and the sustainment of the process. That gift of love comes to meet us in many ways, depending on where we are and what we need. And so there's no one phenomenology of the gift of divine love. There's no one description of it. And that can be offered to people saying, well, if you haven't had this experience, you haven't experienced the gift of divine love. It depends on where you are and what you need. And so it can come in many different ways, and that's the whole question of discernment. How is it being offered, and how can we read it? It's a quite nuanced question, or it's a question that demands a very nuanced answer. To the extent that the gift of divine love is mediated through the external word of Jesus Christ and the Christian tradition, the response to that gift is Christian conversion. And we'll see as we move on later in the course that Christian conversion is a specific differentiation of religious conversion, and it does add something unique to religious conversion, but I don't want to get into that at the present. Now, as the gift of love penetrates ever more deeply into human consciousness, it begins next to transform the criterion of one's moral decision. The gift of love moves, according to the schema of consciousness that we've been using, from the fifth level to the fourth level of consciousness. It liberates a person from the automatic stimulus-response mechanisms of a person who is locked in certain affective patterns. Love opens up, liberates those responses. And it enables the person's feelings to move beyond the narrow confines of neurotic need or of satisfaction, or of compulsion, and to respond to values that carry the person beyond himself or herself. The space that is opened up by the gift of love frees a person's affectivity to respond to persons and objects that carry me beyond neurotic need, satisfaction, superego compulsion, whatever my particular affective problem may be, so that I can respond to something because it is worthwhile, not because it is simply an automatic response of my narrow, confined affectivity, however that may be imprisoned in myself. Sustained moral living is possible only to the extent that affective freedom has been given to the person. Sustained moral living. Or another way of putting it, a person's spontaneous response to the world of genuine value is in direct proportion to that person's affective freedom. The spontaneous response of a person to the world of values is in direct proportion to that person's affective freedom. It's in feelings that we respond to values first. That we first recognize and apprehend possible values. And a person's spontaneous openness to the world of real values proportional to that person's affective freedom. Freedom from the narrow confines of neurotic need, satisfaction, compulsion, obsession, and so on and so forth. All right. Before a detailed presentation of some of this material, particularly on the relationship between feelings and values, there's some material in Chapter 2 of Lonergan's Method in Theology on feelings and their relationship to values. Okay, that basically is what we saw in the last class. Now, are there any questions?
One distinction that I'd be interested in, I sort of distinguish in my own mind between what I would call full spontaneous personal love and therapeutic love. And I would see them both as providing the same space. If you go along, in fact, those are two different things, and they both work.
Yeah. Yes, I would. I agree with that. Yes.
Just to clarify what you mean by mystical union, did you mean that in the sense of end as moving principle, the way that Aristotle comes to speak? Didn't you say that somehow this union was sustained in through the process of conversion?
The gift of love. It sustains the person through the process of conversion. By mystical union, I mean the fruit, the ultimate fruit of the gift of divine love. In the experience, for instance, as it's paradigmatic in the Christian tradition, of an Augustine, a Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, at least in my tradition. You know, that having passed through. It's represented in different ways in different authors, but Teresa's Seven Mansions of the Inner Being or John of the Cross's Dark Night of the Senses and Dark Night of the Spirit, you come to a position of complete purification from everything that would keep you from constant, continual union with the divinity. That sort of thing. That's what I mean by mystical union. That's the end result. One of the end results of the gifts of religious of the process of religious conversion. It's not the beginning. The sustaining thing is the gift of love that is given, accepted, and then worked out in terms of the ongoing relationship.
I just wonder, though, that in existential terms I can see that, but in terms of what moves Christian community, mm-hmm. It is that end that, say, Augustine speaks of as
his final cause. Huh?
Veritas, yeah.
I guess I'm looking at it more from the standpoint of efficient causality, if you want, rather than final causality.
Right.
But I would agree with that. Yeah, I would. The end that moves is that. Yes. John,
I'm having difficulty imagining person opening themselves to an offer of love of God without having to mediate by human love. I'm just not sure that just because I haven't, you know, experienced it, or it seems like it'd be almost impossible.
I don't think you are. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons for the theologically viewed, for the necessity of the incarnation as external word manifesting the gift of divine love, so that it can be seen and heard and accepted. You know, but I do think, for instance, the experience of Paul that's narrated in the Acts is a direct sort of thing that where there is no, there doesn't seem to be any explicit external mediation of it through a human community at all. It's just completely surprising, unpredictable intervention of the divine realm into his experience that radically changed and affected his life. But that's an unusual form of it. I think that most often, give statistics on this, but most often it is through the mediation. Okay. The new material begins with intellectual conversion. What I'd like to do today is take intellectual and psychic and then 2C and then the material on dreams. And we'll see if we can do all of that. Anyway. without causing all kinds of affective blockages along the way. Among the values in you and in me, among the values that are progressively opened up by affective freedom is the value of truth. As a person becomes affectively free, that person is capable of acknowledging, existentially acknowledging, really acknowledging, not just intellectually acknowledging the value of truth, but acknowledging it in a way that I can follow through on my acknowledgement and pursue truth. I'm free. I have to be freed to pursue the truth, to recognize it as a value, and to give myself to the work, the labor, and perhaps the pain that's involved in discovering the truth, and especially if it's the truth about myself. And in order to come to the truth, there also must be acknowledged the value of understanding. There's no truth without understanding. Truth is correct understanding. So a person can come to prize the truth about himself or herself, despite the pain and the difficulty of seeking and facing that truth, but only to the extent that that affective freedom has been given. For instance, if a person has been opened to the value of a part of himself that he once hated, in other words, the value of healing the darkness, then that person will be opened to the value of the truth about himself, and to the value of understanding the darkness. Now, this would be a description of the most rudimentary form of intellectual conversion. That is to say, intellectual conversion has a number of more or less sophisticated manifestations or expressions, but in its most rudimentary form, intellectual conversion is the use of the mind in its native capacity to understand correctly. That's the most rudimentary meaning of intellectual conversion. I start using my mind for what it's capable of doing, understanding correctly. I cease to flee understanding. Lonergan speaks many times in Insight, if you've read it, you know, of the flight from understanding. And particularly when it deals with ourselves, the flight from understanding can be a rocket ship. It takes off and it never comes back. It soars into the stratosphere. Particularly when it's dealing with the truth at times about ourselves. The most rudimentary form of intellectual conversion then is that I begin to use my mind for what it is capable of doing, namely understanding correctly. And I repudiate the flight from understanding, no matter how painful that may be. As I say, that's the most rudimentary form. There are more developed forms of intellectual conversion. I'm not going to go into those in detail, but what they would involve would be an explicit acknowledgement, a philosophical acknowledgement, that the truth is not known by taking a good look, but by raising and answering questions in a certain order, in an intelligent and reasonable fashion. That's the philosophical position. And dealing with epistemology that much this course. But that's a follow-through, that philosophical position, that I don't know the truth just by gaping. But by raising and answering questions in an intelligent and reasonable fashion and appropriating what it is to be intelligent and reasonable and so on, that's a philosophical exercise. It's a more developed form of the rudimentary intellectual conversion, which is that I come now to own my own mind as the instrument of understanding and of affirmation. Okay. I draw back from the animal extroversion of a fearful, disordered psyche. In other words, for a fearful and disordered psyche, the real is what I know by taking a good look at the already out there now. I'm in a world of stimulus response, and